What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
What's stopping
you? I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey everybody, welcome again to Call to Communion here on EWTN, the program for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. If you've got a question about the Catholic faith, that is why this program exists on a Catholic network, to answer the questions that you have. Now today we're not going to be taking your phone calls because we're doing a special mailbag edition of our program. Mailbag's getting a little heavy these days. Got a lot of emails over the past few weeks, so we're going to try to tackle them on today's program. So I'm working with our producer, Pedro Quiles. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David
Tom,
Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
You know what? I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm so glad to hear it. I'm doing decent. Thank you.
Your summer is progressing nicely, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, the temperature has been bearable recently, where it was unbearable for a while. It's hot, but bearable.
You know, it's funny because, and I was talking about this to my wife last night, when I was going to school, our school didn't have air conditioning. I mean, I'm talking about elementary school.
I know, and you guys used to walk uphill both ways to school barefoot in the snow.
Now, wait a minute. It wasn't that bad. But we didn't have air conditioning. And we didn't have air conditioning in junior high either. It wasn't until high school that we had
central air. Yeah, that's right. You know, my mother tells me stories not only about new air conditioning, but back when she had to wear, like, 50 layers of everything that was appropriate for girls in Alabama in the 1950s, including
sure.
Long white gloves,
Well, got to have those long white gloves.
And I'm glad I don't have to wear long white gloves.
Here's an interesting question to lead us off. This is an email from Maurice. What is so special about the Carmelite order? I've heard them talk about the science of the cross. Can this really be a science? And what's that? What makes them different from other orders? Thanks, Maurice.
Yeah, thanks. So the Carmelite religious order is a contemplative order, meaning that their charism is not some active work of mercy towards the world. Like, some orders are into education, some orders are into healthcare. The Carmelite order really is directed to the development of the interior life, which Jesus does tell us is the most important thing. You remember the famous story about Mary and Martha, and Martha is the one that is doing the active stuff, and that's good. There's nothing wrong with the active stuff. But when she fusses at Mary for not doing the active stuff, Jesus says, well, Mary has chosen the better part. And St. Paul says that we can have a life filled with good works, so to speak. We can have lots of religious activity, even talented religious activity. But if we don't have love developed in our hearts, then that stuff is really for naught. And so whatever you do in life, the Catholic is meant to have a contemplative dimension to their existence. Some people have the vocation of working primarily full-time, as it were, on the development of the interior life. And what distinguishes the Carmelite order, I think, apart from their specific charism, is that some of the saints that the Carmelites have produced, like Teresa of Avila and John of the Cross, are both doctors of the Church whose writings on the mystical life have really become authoritative. And so if you were to enroll in, say, one of the Roman universities and get a graduate degree in spiritual theology, you'd find that the terms of the study would largely be framed by Teresian spirituality or John of the Cross. They could really kind of define what that course of study would look like, or they'd be sort of bedrock texts for that tradition.
Very good. Are you familiar with this science of the cross?
So she may be referring, or he may be referring to the a central theme in John of the Cross's writing, which is, it's... In one sense, it's nothing unique to Carmelites because it's the call of every Christian to take up one's cross and follow Jesus and to pattern oneself after the crucified. But John's articulation of that doctrine, sometimes called the nada doctrine for nothing, meaning be attached to nothing, let nothing come between you and God, is understood to be a particularly poignant, ascetic, and challenging articulation of that central truth of the Christian life. That may be what she's referring to.
Maurice, thank you so much thank you so much for your email. Great way to kick things off. We also have a text here that came in from Sierra. Are there special graces for being buried in a Catholic cemetery, or does it not matter where you are buried after a Catholic funeral? Thanks, Sierra.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So the church has fairly detailed funeral rites. And you know, one of the reasons to be buried in a sacred space is so that you will be remembered to the faithful when they offer prayers for the repose of for the dead, that they'll remember to pray for you too. In antiquity, people often wanted to be buried in close proximity to the relics of saints because those typically were pilgrimage sites, and people would go celebrate Mass in honor of the saint and be kind of nice to. If you're in the vicinity, maybe people would offer up Mass for your soul. And so, you know, nothing that's done to a dead body has anything to do with, you know, say, the merits that you will receive in heaven, nothing like that. But it does have to do with sort of the, how to put it, I don't know, the sort of the liturgical orientation of the church towards the dead, which does have an effect, right? Because the prayers of the church are efficacious, particularly for the suffering souls in purgatory.
Some cities and towns have Catholic cemeteries. Many do not. Some, like here in Birmingham, have sort of a Catholic section.
That's right.
And so it goes.
And you know, I mean, we don't really know what the resurrection is going to be like. I mean, St. Paul tells us it's not going to be like what we think. Eye hasn't seen, ear hasn't heard what God has in store for those who love him. But there is a resurrection of the body. And you know, some people think it'd be pretty neat to pop up out of the ground with folks that you know. Catholics over here.
Yeah. I know of two cemeteries here in Birmingham that actually have Catholic sections. And the one, Elmwood, has a rather large Catholic section, and that is where Father Coyle of happy memory passed away about 100 years ago.
Yes, I use his gravestone as a marker. Because,
oh, really?
Yes, because it's very noticeable. He's got this big Celtic cross, you know, and it sort of stands up above the rest. And whenever I'm looking for the Catholic section, I'm like, where's Father Coyle? As soon as I see Coyle's tombstone, I'm like, I'm in the right place. It's easy to get lost in a cemetery.
Yes, it is.
And that particular spot, I know the one you're talking about, it's like priest and religious row. It's like Father so-and-so, Sister so-and-so, Father so-and-so, Sister so-and-so. And I have friends that are dead and buried in that cemetery, and I like to go out there and pray for them and ask for their prayers.
Sierra, thank you so much for your text. By the way, when we are doing live programming, you can always text the letters EWTN to 58177. Wait for our response, then text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. Primarily, though, we're going to be getting to a lot of emails in this special mailbag edition of Call to Communion here on EWTN. Do stay with us. It's Call to Communion with Dr. David Andrews here on this Monday afternoon on EWTN. Not taking your phone calls today, we're doing a special mailbag edition of our program. If you would like to send us an email for a future show, here's the address, ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. Before we get to our next email, I want to tell you about a wonderful book available from EWTN's religious catalog, and that is called His Angels at Our Side, Understanding Their Power in Our Souls and in the World by Father John Horgan of happy memory. He unveils in this book the surprising role of the angels in our lives and what you must do to gain their help. You'll learn how to imitate the angels in prayer, also how they offer you the enlightenment and encouragement that God so desperately wants to give you. You know, by praying with the angels, you'll be strengthened for what lies ahead and be better able to discern and do the Lord's will in all of your actions. And that's what we need to be about. Here's the book, His Angels at Our Side, Understanding Their Power in Our Souls and in the World by Father John Horgan. Available now at EWTN's religious catalog, Buy Catholic, Shop Catholic, shop EWTNRC.com. Here's an interesting email here from Adolfo. He says, in the 1960s, I remember going to Mass and always kissing the priest's hand. When did this stop?
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So it is traditional to kiss consecrated hands because of the hands that bring us the sacraments, in particular the Blessed Sacrament, the presence of Christ himself.
Uh-huh.
But I think particularly after the Council, sometimes some of the adornments to the liturgy, and that's what they are, they're really adornments, they're not essentials of the liturgy, have passed out of common use. And sometimes I think that can be a good thing.
Yeah.
If they are prone to misunderstanding. And I think that's a particular gesture that can easily be misunderstood by a non-Catholic or misused, even misunderstood by Catholics. I mean, for example, if that gesture were to encourage in the laity or the priesthood the sin of clericalism, right?
Yeah.
If it took place in a context that tended to foment clericalism, then I think it should be omitted. On the other hand, there are circumstances where I think it could be quite beneficial if someone were having Donatist schismatic thoughts because they thought, well, the priest isn't a great guy and therefore maybe the sacraments aren't valid. In response to that kind of sentiment, Francis of Assisi once, famous story about St. Francis, when there was a priest in his town that was a flagrant adulterer and an immoral man. And so the brothers went to Francis and they're like, Francis, do you know what Father so-and-so is up to? And so Francis, girds himself and puts on his shoes and hops up and starts marching off resolutely towards the priest. And everybody thinks, this priest is going to get it. Francis, the holy man's going to give him what for, and Francis goes and pounds on the door of the rectory and the priest comes, kind of bleary-eyed to the door. And there's Francis with this big throng behind him, whereupon Francis drops to his knees and kisses the man's hands and says, this is how I treat the hands that bring me Christ. And it was the right gesture in that context because the people were tempted to the heretical idea that an immoral priest invalidates the sacraments, which, of course, is not true. So, different contexts, different gestures, I think, can be appropriate. Now, I do want to say one thing about the immoral priest who doesn't invalidate the sacraments. It's a dogma of the faith that the worthiness of the minister has nothing to do with the validity of the sacrament. So you don't have to worry, you don't have to scruple about, say, well, what if that priest that baptized me, what if he was a bad guy and I've just found out now? No, you're still baptized. Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
Right? Though it doesn't affect the validity of the sacraments, the morality of the priest absolutely affects the efficacy of the sacraments because it will affect the charity and the faithfulness of the faithful as they receive them.
Hmm.
And so if, for example, the scandalous behavior of a priest causes the laity to sin, right? Because he's setting a bad moral example.
Sure, sure.
Then that is going to affect their reception of the sacraments very negatively, and they will not receive all the grace that they need. Sacraments may be objectively valid, but they're not going to get everything out of them that they should because they've been led into sin by the scandalous example of the priest. So the fact that they're valid isn't an excuse for priests to behave immorally. The call of a priest is to holiness of life, and his obligation to holiness is greater than that of the laity because of the position that he holds. St. James says, you shouldn't, many of you, aspire to be priests and teachers because you're going to be judged more harshly for your immoral behavior. So if you're called to the priesthood, you better be committed to holiness of life, irrespective of the doctrine of the validity of the sacraments.
Adolfo, thanks so much for your email. Here's one from Sam who says, I heard a Catholic priest who was also an anthropologist say that Satan is a creation of culture and traced his common depictions through history. At the end, we all left thinking that Jesus was a wonderful psychologist and that people who believe in these things are fundamentalist. Can you talk about this? Is evil some abstract absence of God?
Okay, thanks. I really appreciate the question. I need to untangle a lot of distinctions here, okay? On the one hand, I can talk about Satan. I want to talk about the person of God, too,
okay. Right?
Because this is really true of any kind of image of religious truths in the Catholic faith. As an anthropologist, as a historian of religion, as a sociologist, it is absolutely possible, and it's even fruitful, to study the history of religious doctrines. And so it's quite possible. It's eminently reasonable, for example, to write a book about the history of God, like Karen Armstrong does, for example, where you look at, okay, well, in this period of history, folks had this concept of God. In this period of history, they had this concept of God. Maybe you went from a kind of nature religion to a certain kind of temple polytheism, maybe to an evolution to henotheism, which is many gods, but, you know, one top dog god who's like, you know, my god, you know, kind of the big guy on the block, and from there into monotheism, and then from a kind of generic monotheism into something even more rarefied and sublime, like, say, an Aristotelian or a Platonic or a Neoplatonic monotheism, which is a far more philosophically astute way of stating the picture. It is absolutely possible to trace the history of religious ideas like that. Now, but the fact that religious ideas have an evolution, have a history, doesn't mean that they don't convey truth. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, yes.
Right? And from the Catholic point of view, that kind of evolution of religious thinking is part of the preparation for the gospel. In fact, Irenaeus of Lyon, I think, gave a brilliant answer to the standard pagan objection. Ancient pagans, like Celsus, for example, objected to Christianity on the grounds that, well, if God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, why did he wait eons upon eons? Like, why did he do it in this century rather than, you know, at the beginning of time?
Yeah, yeah.
And the answer that St. Irenaeus gives to that question, I think, is a very compelling one. He says, mankind had to become habituated to the divine logos. And what does that mean? Well, you know, in John chapter 1, it tells us that the Word, the Logos, became flesh and dwelt among us. That's the incarnation. And he says the Logos is that very same light of reason that inspired every human being to the pursuit of truth, right? So in some fashion, however inchoate, the Word of God was present to all of humanity. But obviously, there is a historical development to the use of reason that enables more and more refined religious ideas. And in the way early Catholics thought about it, those refinements are actually progress, coming closer and closer to the truth of the immaterial and the eternal God.
Right.
And so just as the history of Israel, salvation history, was a preparation for Jesus Christ, so, say, for example, the evolution of Hellenic or Greek philosophy was also a preparation for the gospel in its own way.
Mm.
And the world was receptive to Christian ideas in the first century AD in a way that they probably wouldn't have been in, say, the 10th century before Christ. Right.
Okay.
And so there's you can have your cake and eat it too. You can acknowledge that there is an evolution in religious consciousness without being a relativist about it, and actually see evolution as progress in that domain. In the same way, I think it's possible to trace an evolution in the concept of an adversary, right? That there is an adversary to the divine will. Yes, you can trace that not only in Christianity, but in other world religions. Christianity is not the only religion. Judaism is not the only religion that has that concept. You will find a devil-like figure in other world religions. It's possible to trace that evolution as well. But just like we can trace an evolution in the doctrine of God, I think you'll also find that the concept of the devil, and the church does teach the existence of a personal devil, also gives evidence of a development that the church would understand to be progress. And so, for example, you know, the common depiction of a black bearded red fellow with a pointed spiked tail and a pitchfork, you know, that would be a kind of superstitious way of conceiving of the existence of the devil. The Catholic doctrine is that the angels are immaterial spirits, right? And the bad angels, the wicked angels, are immaterial spirits whose will is permanently deflected away from the good. Now, is evil itself nothing more than the absence of good? Well, that's actually Catholic doctrine.
Ah.
And so you can have an evil will, like the will of the devil, for example, but it's evil insofar as it lacks proper rectitude. So what makes it evil is not something positive, it's a deficiency, it's a privation of the rectitude of will that a will ought to have towards the good. That's what makes it to be evil. So that is a privative doctrine, that's a Neoplatonic understanding of evil, but coheres very well with the Catholic Church's understanding of why the will of the devil happens to be evil.
Sam, thanks so much for your email. We're doing a special mailbag edition of Call to Communion here on EWTN, so no phone calls today. Here is a real Mensa question for you, David. This is from Charles. How have the philosophical currents of the Enlightenment period influenced theology?
That is not a one sentence answer. Right? I mean, in so many ways, in so many ways. I mean, it's very difficult to answer that succinctly. Okay, so in the 18th century, one of the ways that philosophy influenced the development of theology was towards deism, and if not deism, then mechanistic models of divine causation that were, you know, patterned after, say, Newtonian physics or something.
Uh-huh.
And which led to some philosophical mistakes from a Catholic point of view. And so, for example, you know, Richard Dawkins, who was a very celebrated atheist, and he, you know, really doesn't like devoutly religious people and doesn't like what they think, wrote a book attacking religious doctrine, and he called it The Blind Watchmaker. And that is a reference to an argument for the existence of God by one William Paley. Paley was an 18th century Christian apologist who tried to argue for the existence of God on the grounds that reality possessed the kind of internal mechanical order that say, a watch has. And that if you picked up a watch off the beach and you said, well, you know, this couldn't have just be here by accident, in the same way, if you sort of pick the world up or you pick up a living organism or any kind of complexity, you would conclude that it was manufactured by, you know, an intelligence rather like a watchmaker. And there are all kinds of problems with that argument that make it easy to take apart, which is why Dawkins is able to parody it. In essence, when it comes to biological complexity, natural selection, evolution is sufficient to explain that, most people think. And so he says, well, you know, Darwin has done away with Paley's God, and therefore there's no argument for God, right? From a Catholic point of view, that's the wrong way to conceive of God. There's a completely different metaphysical scheme for understanding the relation of God to the world. It's not that of a watchmaker. And I won't go into that right now because it's rather long and to be kind of pedantic. If you want to read, Edward Fezzer goes after the Paley argument at great length. So go pick up one of Ed Fezzer's books like The Last Superstition. You'll get a good treatment of that topic. So that's one way that that Enlightenment philosophy influenced theology, I think, for the bad. We've kind of outgrown that. Another way was in the Romantic movement. And so in response to the sense that, say, somebody like David Hume seemed to undercut a lot of the traditional arguments for God, or Immanuel Kant, you get somebody like Schleiermacher, Friedrich Schleiermacher, German theologian, who says, okay, you know, away with reason, we'll rely on sentiment. Right? Sentiment will be our path towards the divine. And then that creates a further reaction in modern neo-orthodoxy, somebody like Karl Barth, who reacts against Schleiermacher. And so there's sort of, you know, waves and counterwaves of theological thinking. In Catholic theological circles, one of the responses to Enlightenment criticisms of traditional religious doctrine was an insistence upon a return to the model of St. Thomas Aquinas for doing theology. So Leo XIII's encyclical Litani Patris on the use of philosophy in seminary education and encouraging a return to Thomas. And then that in turn gave birth to something called Neo-Thomism, which has a lot of sub-branches. And Neo-Thomism comes in for praise and blame, depending on which side of the aisle you're on. And then a sort of reaction against Neo-Thomism, you get the Nouvelle Théologie, 20th century Catholic theology, with people like Yves Congar and Henri de Lubac and von Balthasar and so forth. So again, kind of waves and counterwaves and all sort of emanating from Enlightenment philosophy. That's kind of a rundown, but I mean, we could go on at great length.
I was just thinking, as you were laying all this out, can you imagine being in a debate with Dawkins?
That's a good question. You know, I think it'd be kind of, we'd be talking past each other.
Maybe
because
so.
Because his area, I mean, he's a very competent biologist, and I'm not, and I have very little say in that domain. And, you know, I don't honestly think he knows as much about theology as he thinks he does, you know?
Yeah.
And so I would like to meet Dr. Dawkins, and I'd like to go out and have coffee with him and talk about this and that, but I do think we would be at risk of talking past one another.
Possibly so. Hey, thank you so much, Charles, for your email. Right after the break, we're going to be coming back with lots more of these wonderful emails we've received over the past couple of weeks here on this special mailbag edition of Call to Communion on this Monday afternoon here on EWTN. Do stay with us. It's Call to Communion on this Monday afternoon here on EWTN Radio. We're not taking your calls today, so please do enjoy these mailbag questions that we've received over the past couple of weeks here on A Call to Communion. To continue, here is one from Adam in Fargo, normally listens to us on the great Real Presence Radio. Dear Dr. Anders, Adam writes, how are we as Catholics supposed to deal with the current trending movement by LGBTQ community and now the government and employers via DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion, to use a different name than the person's birth name with special pronouns based on what feels certain persons feel he or she feels at that moment or time in their life? If someone wants to be called a different name, I don't care. Johns are known as Jack, William, Bill, etc. But the goofy pronoun thing seems too much and contrary to our beliefs. Are we being accomplices with our silence? Thanks for your reply. Sincerely, Adam in Fargo.
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question, Adam. So the Holy See has not said a whole lot on this topic. There is a document that came out a number of years ago, I think probably about 6 or 7 years ago, from the Congregation for Catholic Education, entitled Male and Female, He Created Them, which is a really good statement of the Church's position on the philosophical underpinnings of the gender theory movement. And I highly recommend you take a look at it. But it doesn't deal so much with the practical questions that you're asking. Where it's aimed really is at Catholic schools and how Catholic schools ought to handle it. And so I can speak within that context.
Okay.
It's perfectly reasonable in a Catholic school to say, you know, for purposes of this school, we believe that God made people boys and girls, and that biological sex is a fundamental aspect of identity.
Okay.
And therefore, you know, we're going to respect that, and we respect you, and everybody's welcome to be here, and we love you all. But here, you know, if you are biologically female, you know, you're going to wear the skirt if that's what the uniform is, and if you're biologically male, you're going to wear the pants. And you know, you're going to, if you're a girl, you're going to use the girl's bathroom. And if you're a boy, you're going to use the boy's bathroom. And you know, if I call on her in class, I'm going to call on her in class. I mean, that, and you let people know if you're coming to this school, that's what you're signing up for. It doesn't mean we're bigots. It doesn't mean we hate you. We're not trying to make you feel terrible, but that's the way we do it here. And if you're okay with that, then come on in. You know, we would welcome anybody, no matter what their situation. In fact, we'd rather you come to the Catholic school, regardless of whether or not you're Catholic,
sure.
Regardless of whether or not you think we're right. Mm-hmm. We'd rather you be here than not, all right? But those are the terms. We're just going to set them out up front, okay? And we're not making you come. You come or go. It's your choice, you know? But if you're here, that's what we're going to do. And so that's how we would handle it in that context. Now, personally, this, I'm giving you my own private opinion
yes.
here, just as one who's thought about this issue quite a bit. I think for me, the most helpful way to think about the whole gender theory business is, this is not just a metaphor I'm getting ready to give you. I think this is a reality. Right? I think it's a religion. And what I mean by religion is a concept of the sacred and a beliefs and practices ordered to that concept of the sacred that establishes a moral, and I put moral in quotes here, in the sense that they have a doctrine of the moral life, a moral community, all right? And I'm getting that definition from sociology. So it's a sort of standard way of conceiving of what is, when sociologists go out to study religion, that's the sort of animal they're looking for, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Some kind of concept of the sacred that's sort of bound up in rites and practices and beliefs that establishes, you know, the boundaries of a moral community that adheres to that, right? And I think that pretty well captures what's going on here. And when I talk about the sacred, I mean the sacred in a sociological context. Obviously, you know, for me as a Catholic, I think God is sacred, Jesus Christ is sacred, the sacraments are sacred. But as a historian of religion, if I'm going to go study, like, say, what is the Confucian concept of the sacred, right? The sacred would be the thing that sort of takes you out of the ordinary. The sacred is the thing that you're not allowed to criticize. You know, the sacred is the thing that your community treats as ultimate. The sacred is the thing that makes you feel like your life has meaning, that establishes your identity. And these kinds of things are what you would identify with the sacred or sacredness. And I think that for this community, what they conceive of as sacred is the utterly free, utterly autonomous individual subjectivity. right? My self-definition is what's sacred. And that I believe it has a kind of, I think there's a conversion narrative, much like you would find in evangelical Protestantism or Puritanism. You know, that's why you will sometimes hear the language of people who are quote unquote woke. You know, that's a metaphor drawn from the Christian tradition and other religious traditions as well, who often use the metaphor of awakening from sleep for people who have quote unquote seen the light. You know, whatever the light may be, whether it's a kind of a Buddhist enlightenment or, you know, St. Paul says, rise from the dead, O sleeper, and Christ's light will shine on you. Or, you know, Plato's myth of the cave. A lot of religious traditions have this idea of sort of waking up from some kind of dream world or illusion towards a deeper reality. They think that about their system, that once you sort of wake up to the reality of this inner subjective consciousness that is all powerful and all sacred and can never be questioned, you know, you're awake, right? So there's a conversion narrative there. They definitely have a moral system that they seek to impose not only on their own members but on the world, and that is that everybody else's use of language, in particular, but also their laws, their institutions, particularly institutions of family life as well as employment, should cater to that ultimate sacred sense of the self that stands at the heart of the sort of the gender movement, right? And nobody can question it. That's why, you know, one definition I offered of the sacred is the thing that you can't question, right? If you, like in the Catholic Church, if you start saying, well, I'm not so sure there's a Trinity, well, we still love you, but that puts you outside the bounds of the Catholic Church. Like, you're out at that point. You're not Catholic anymore, right? Well, if you start saying, well, I'm not so sure about that concept of gender, well, you know, you're not part of the group anymore. You're out, you know? They definitely have a concept of orthodoxy and heresy. Definitely have that concept of orthodoxy and heresy. And they, you know, they have their witch trials. You know, they definitely go in for these people are bad and they need to be done away with and they need to be enlightened and so forth. So to me, it feels, as a religious historian, a lot like 17th century New England Puritanism in its sort of religious culture, but they've swapped out, you know, the God of Puritanism and the specific rites and rituals of Puritanism for these different ideas, but in structure and tone, it feels to me very puritanical. So that's how I relate to it. I think, okay, these are, it's kind of a religious fundamentalism of a sort. And what I mean by a fundamentalist in this context is somebody that takes their ideas very literally with very little nuance and very little tolerance for dissent, right? It's a kind of a fundamentalist religion. I think it has a tendency to be a bit totalitarian, right? Because the vision that they have of the world, particularly in their demands about the use of language, are totalitarian. They think this needs to be implemented at a social level, whether or not you agree with them. And if you don't toe the line, well, then doggone it, they're going to let you know, right? And a lot of times through social ostracization and other forms of sanction. All right, so I think that's what I'm dealing with. You know, I think that's what I'm dealing with. That helps me conceptualize it and helps guide me in making prudent choices. Okay, I also think that people who are deeply into this are in the grip of an ideology that sometimes has run away with the intellect because there's a lot of theses that I articulated there that are beyond reason. What I mean by that is they can't be rationally verified. There's no independent, objective, or scientific way to verify them. You know, the key one being that that I have a kind of privileged, subjective, infallible insight into my own, you know, this is the very ephemeral term, gender, which is very hard to get a definition out of them of what that is, right? It's very hard to get a clear definition of what that is. But I alone have privileged access to that, and whatever I say it is, you cannot question it. You cannot call it into question. That strikes me as dogma number one for the movement, right? I can't independently verify that. That strikes me as, you know, really. But when you get into that kind of mindset, like, you can't reason people out of those kind of fundamentalist beliefs. I'm not going to go to the analogy. I was going to give an analogy, but I'm not going to.
Okay.
You can't reason people out of that, right?
Yeah.
And when people get into an ideological system, it's usually because they want meaning in their life and they want to shore up their identity in a way that validates that sense of meaning. And look, people will do anything for meaning. People will sacrifice their children to Moloch for meaning. People will sacrifice themselves for meaning. People will sacrifice the world for meaning. They will do anything for meaning. Meaning is a very, very, very high value for very many people. I don't necessarily respect the ideas, but I respect the grip that the passionate quest for meaning can have on people. And when folks arrive at a religious conclusion that they believe gives their life meaning, I respect the fact that it is nigh unto impossible to pry them out of that, right? And so there are times, if I'm in dialogue with somebody like that, where I'm going to pick my battles very carefully, right? Because there are a lot of things I can say or do that will only inflame and will not bring understanding, will not move the conversation one inch forward towards common ground, okay? There are other contexts, however, where I'm not going to give an inch. Yeah. So here's one where I'm not going to give an inch. My Catholic school. I'm not giving an inch. When it comes to my Catholic school, here are the rules, buddy. If you don't want to be in the Catholic school, you don't have to be. You know, there's 1,000 public schools in Portland you can go to. You know, you don't have to come to my Catholic school. You know, sure. I'd love you to. I invite you to. But you don't have to, all right? I'm not imposing it on you. Please don't impose your thing on me, all right? So when it comes to my children, you know, you keep your ideology and your laws off of my kids' body parts.
There right? it is. Yeah. That's,
you know, and there are states in our country where that, the autonomy of parents over their children's lives is being called into question because of this. And I think that's very dangerous, right? So, you know, please, you have your ideology. You hold it as a sacred trust, whatever.
Yeah.
Don't impose it on my children. Don't impose it on my school. Don't impose it on my conscience. Now, I may show you all kinds of deference and kindness, and I may refrain from saying things that I'd like to say out of respect for you. Like, for example, the pronoun business.
Yeah.
You can, it's awkward, but you can have a whole conversation without ever using a second person pronoun.
Yes, you can.
Well, excuse me, without using a third person pronoun.
I know what you meant.
Right.
Yeah.
You can stick with second person pronouns. You, at least in the English language, you know, that's gender neutral, you know.
Yeah.
And you can always revert back to the proper name, you know.
Sure.
So, did you see Kelly's tennis swing at Kelly's game?
Yeah.
Kelly's good at what Kelly does. You know.
Oh, sure. You can
and,
do it.
I'm not giving up my beliefs, but I can also do it in a way that's not intentionally inflammatory.
Sure.
Unless I'm in a context where I feel like, you know, like I said, this is the Catholic school.
Sure.
Right? I'm the announcer at the Catholic tennis match. She had a good swing.
There it is. You got to leave it. I don't think I've ever talked about this, but way back when I was a little kid, I had a stuttering problem. Did you know that? Did I ever talk about that?
And maybe.
And if I could kind of think ahead with what I was going to say, and I could say, uh-oh, here it comes. I'm going to stutter there. And so I would work the context. I would change the language in my head so that I wouldn't say that particular sentence.
Sure.
And I've eventually worked my way out of all that stuttering.
Yep. Let me say one more thing about this.
Yeah, yeah.
I just had a long description of why I think of all this as a religious movement, and some of it I think is manifestly beyond reason. It's the sort of thing that one could not rationally know to be true. Having said that, I don't want to be misunderstood. I definitely think that there are people who suffer from gender dysphoria, that is scientifically verifiable, and we can talk about that objectively, all right? And what I mean by that is there are some people who are very uncomfortable with their biological sex and would like very much to be something else. That's a thing. We can talk about it objectively. We can analyze it scientifically. We can come up with treatment protocols that are empirically verifiable. That I believe, right?
Yeah.
What I don't think is the ideology that has been imposed on that reality, right, that includes a lot of unverifiable and unscientific things. I don't think you have to go along with that. I don't have any problem with the science, all right? And I definitely don't want to demean people in any way at all. If you have this issue, if this is important to you, if you're suffering in this way, I want to be as open and understanding and listening and compassionate to you as I can. but I don't feel obligated to surrender my intellect in the process.
Adam in Fargo, thank you so much for your email. Certainly led to a fascinating discussion here on Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on EWTN. Let me tell you about another wonderful podcast now available on EWTN's Podcast Central. I just love the name of this. Just a Guy in the Pew. That's John Edwards. We're talking Catholic man to Catholic man, real honest conversations from the heart. Just a Guy in the Pew discusses the struggles, challenges, and unimaginable joy of following Christ. You can hear this and other faith-filled podcasts from our friends and affiliates around the world, all in one place, all absolutely free at EWTN Podcast Central. Here's how you get there, EWTN.com/radio. Click on the words Podcast Central. Do check it out. We've got almost 100 podcasts that we update almost daily. So a fascinating one and a very humble guy, John Edwards, titling his podcast, Just a Guy in the Pew. Some great knowledge for you there. Here's a wonderful email from Wendy in New Orleans. Hi, Dr. Anders. I have some family members who are not Catholic, but they do go to church on Sunday and they do believe. They aren't really faithful to any religion. They think Jesus died for our sins and that's it. Now, I'm talking about my mom and her fourth husband. My dad does not go to church at all. He does believe in God, but thinks that I'm just, you know, kind of religious now. I'm not sure what is in his heart, really. As a Catholic myself, I'm wondering what it means for me to be an intentional disciple and if I should be working on or sharing my faith to help with their conversion. Sometimes I feel the only way to true conversion is via the Holy Spirit. Dr. Anders, I do need your help. I want to be a good Catholic and help with their conversions. Sometimes I think the only thing I can do is pray. Please advise me on this, as you have been most helpful in answering previous questions about the Catholic faith. God bless. Wendy in New Orleans.
Thanks. I really appreciate the question. So, you know, there's a lot in sacred scripture about the development of the Christian life, about the aims and goals of Christian life. One of my favorite passages is Ephesians chapter 1, verse 17 and following, where St. Paul says, I ask that the God of our Lord Jesus Christ give you the spirit of wisdom and revelation so that you may know him better. Right? I pray that the eyes of your heart may be enlightened. I just love that text.
Yeah.
The eyes of your heart may be enlightened in order that you might know the hope to which he's called you, the riches of his glorious inheritance and his holy people, and his incomparably great power for those of us who believe. And you know, Paul goes on in this and his other epistles to talk about what that growth in the knowledge of God looks like. And it means a transformation of one's moral life, the growth in holiness, a detachment from sin, a purification. As we come more and more to imitate the life of the crucified, giving our own lives and our own bodies and out of love for neighbor and love for God in imitation of Christ who gave himself. And so, you know, we receive the grace of God in baptism, but that's not the end of the story. The end of the story is this lifelong perfection and holiness that has very definite steps in Catholic theology, you know, the purgation of sin, detachment from the world, coming more and more to share the mind of Christ, being able to see reality through Jesus' eyes until finally our wills are so perfectly and intimately united with God's that we will one thing, we will what God wills. And then, you know, we get to that point, we can say, not I, but Christ who lives within me. And so that's a very clear vision of the Christian moral life. And, you don't ever know for sure, how am I doing? You know, that's why having a spiritual director is a good idea. It's good to have objective eyes on you. It's hard to be judge of oneself. We turn it over to the providence of God. We trust in his mercy, but we strive ever further in that direction. But you have some indications that you're making progress. You know, if you, let's say you may have an addiction in your life, and then one day you wake up and realize, man, I hadn't done that thing in 3 years now. Like I know I'm weak and I could fall, but like, I seem to be beating that.
I seem to be beating that.
Well, that's an indicator of progress. What if you habitually yell at your wife, and then one day you realize, you know what? She did that annoying thing again, and I didn't raise my voice. Right? It was still annoying, but I didn't raise my voice. You know? And then I haven't raised my voice in 3 months. Like, maybe I'm starting to beat that one. You know? Or maybe you haven't habitually given your time to prayer or to the study of divine things, and suddenly you find, you know what, I've been been reading the Divine Office every day for 6 weeks now, or I just kind of can't wait to the next time to get to Mass, or whatever it is in your life, and you're like, I seem to be developing a taste for the sacred that I didn't previously have. All these things are indications, not infallible indications, yeah. Indications you're kind of moving on the right path, right? And so, you know, when as Catholics, when we look at our separated Christian brethren that are in non-denominational churches or whatnot, they come by and go, well, you know, Jesus died for us, and that's the end of the story. Well, you know, I grieve a little bit for them. I don't hate them. I don't think they're terrible people. But it's clear that that's a more anemic conception of the Christian life than what we have as Catholics. What yeah. I've just proposed to you is, I think, a very robust doctrine of the Christian life that gives me something very concretely to do with myself. I know what to strive for on a day-to-day basis, and I know what the path looks like, and I know what finishing the path looks like. And there are a lot of people who have a Christian life that is, I think, more empty, honestly. It's more devoid of meaning. And sometimes the lack of meaning, because there's a lack of a real doctrine of the spiritual life, will get filled with other things. And so there's one kind of Christian person who will say, and I've heard this from people, well, you know, I got the salvation thing down, right? I prayed my prayer, invited Jesus into my heart. So I guess now what I'll do is become an investment banker and, you know, make a lot of money. Right? Because, like, I got the salvation thing down. I've got heaven in the bag. I might as well get the earth in the bag, too. Right? I've met that guy, yeah. Right? And there have been times in my life when I've been tempted to be that guy. Mm. I mean, I'm not making the investment banking money, you know, but, like, the thought, like, well, I got the religious thing down. I'll do this other thing, right? I've been there in my own life, and I, you know, the people who have to. Well, that's a shame, right? My life would be is poorer when I'm thinking that way.
Yeah.
All right. Here's another danger. Well, I got the salvation thing down, so what do I do with myself? Well, and I've heard this too. I remember there was a well-known Protestant radio preacher that took this line exactly. Well, you got the salvation thing down, so now what you have to do is go proselytize. You got to get as many other people get the salvation thing down as possible, and it becomes a kind of a contest to see who can win the most converts.
Notches in the belt.
And notches in the belt, which is a very dehumanizing way to go about evangelization, right? It turned people into marks. You're like, I'm like some carny, you know, in a traveling circus, and I'm just out there to exploit you for my own sense of religious meaning, right? That's a dangerous thing. Another one would be, you know, maybe I get wrapped up in apocalyptic thinking. Ah, well, the world's going to end tomorrow and everything's going to go up in smoke. And so, you know, I need to jump on board with some radical political ideology. There's a lot of ways to fill that hole when the pursuit of holiness and purity of life is not your aim in religious life. And so it's sad when people are in that situation. As a Catholic, how do I relate to them? Well, first of all, you do what Martha did in the Gospel of Luke, right? You focus on the one thing necessary, which is your own growth and holiness. That's always the number one thing. You focus on your own interior life and your imitation of Christ, and then you focus on loving the people that God puts in your life, like your family, as authentically as possible, and you rely on the supernatural infused virtue of prudence to discern, how can I best help them incrementally forward in their life at this moment?
Okay.
Do I have to get them all 100% into the Catholic faith tomorrow? Probably not going to happen.
Yeah.
But let's say one of them is, like we mentioned, addiction.
Yeah.
One of them says, I got that salvation thing down, so now I'll go get high. I've met that guy too.
Wow.
I've met that guy. Mm. Well, maybe becoming a Carmelite religious isn't in the bag for him right now, but helping him get off of his addiction is. You see,
yeah,
you just find that thing in their life that you think you can, and maybe all you can do is sit down and have pie with them. Well, let's have some pie.
Yeah, let's have some pie. Wendy, thanks so much. And here's a quick one from Luis in Brazil, who says he's a big fan of the show. Dr. Anders, what sect of Judaism did Jesus belong to? Was he a Pharisee like Paul, a Sadducee, an Essene, a Zealot? Was there such a thing as a non-denominational Jew back in apostolic times?
Okay, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So, of course, he wasn't any of them.
Okay.
Because he criticized all of them.
Ah.
And the whole point of Christ's messiahship was that he didn't conform to all of the expectations of the different sects and groups with which he spoke. However, we can identify some groups that he had more affinity with than others. as much as he criticized the Pharisees, he was closer to them in religious outlook and worldview than he was to, say, the Sadducees, who didn't even believe in the prophets or the resurrection.
Yeah.
In Matthew 19, when Jesus mentioned those who have made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven, he was probably talking about the Essenes in Qumran, from whom John the Baptist seems to have hailed. And so he definitely would have disagreed with a lot that they did, but seems to have embraced and affirmed their practice of celibacy. So, you know, you can see elements in those traditions that he affirmed.
Fascinating. Luis, thanks so much. Glad that you're listening to us in Brazil. Dr. David Anders, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Tom.
Don't forget, we do this program Monday through Friday, and that includes tomorrow. We'll see you on Tuesday's edition of Call to Communion. I'm Tom Price. Have a great day, and God bless.